KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles. And if you like to shell out a few bucks, you know, keep us up and running so I can have nice conversation in a cool voice like this. Pick up the phone and call 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-KPFK. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Dan Navarro, host of Strike Line here on KPFK. Join me Wednesdays at 5 p.m. Pacific for news, perspectives, and notes from the front lines of the SAG-AFTRA and WGA strikes, and more. It's a hot labor summer, so join us Wednesdays at 5 p.m. right here on KPFK 90.7 and also at kpfk.org.
Welcome to Gray Zone Radio. This week we're going to listen to a portion of Friday's live stream, which was a roundtable between Max Blumenthal, Kit Clarenberg, Alex Rubinstein, and Wyatt Reed on the latest developments from Ukraine. To hear the entire broadcast, go to the Gray Zone YouTube channel. And to read interesting news, go to thegrayzone.com. That's thegrayzone.com. Now, let's take a listen to this interesting roundtable.
You reported the blueprint that this kind of cabal within British military intelligence, led by Chris Donnelly, the architect of the Integrity Initiative secret troll farm, had conceived, which laid out plans for attacking the bridge, and it's been attacked again and again. It's not doing much, but I think this is what we're going to see in the long term after the second. I don't even know if there's going to be a spring counteroffensive after that fails. But let's get to your latest piece. This really spells out why the counteroffensive, one reason why the counteroffensive has completely failed, and why I don't know what they're talking about in the spring, but there might not be an army in the spring for this,
or a Ukraine
second chance, a Ukrainian army. But this is a piece you just wrote, Western press fetishizes Ukrainian amputees. And I found this photo just from a medical clinic that has offices across the US that's taking in Ukrainian amputees because there's so many of them. They basically have to be farmed out throughout Europe and the United States. And this is a veteran who lost his arm. And what you did that I think is so significant in this piece, Kit, is you extrapolated out of the total reported by the Wall Street Journal of Ukrainian amputees, the possible total of casualties. And it's staggering. It's shocking. I mean, a substantial slice of the entire Ukrainian population has been lost to this proxy war, which is being guided from Brussels and Washington.
Yeah, I mean, there was an absolutely remarkable statistic published by an institute in Kiev recently, which was that 78% of Ukrainians know someone or are related to someone who's died in the war, which is just, you know, kind of completely unimaginable. Like, you know, like transpose that data to the US or the UK. I mean, it would just, I mean, absolutely shocking. But yeah, so I mean, that article was very, that Wall Street Journal report was very revealing. And yes, like if you look at past US medical and military studies of the rate of amputations in war, they're pretty static despite the, you know, developments in science and healthcare. But also, I mean, you know, Ukraine does not have access to all of those benefits. And in fact, there was this remarkable quote from a Ukrainian physician who said that now amputee centers in Ukraine need to be as common as dentists. Like, the, you know, every village, every town, every city has to have one or more. It's mind-boggling, really. And yes, like, I mean, it's a reflection of how things have just gotten so bad that they can't suppress it anymore. You know, I think like a lot of arguments about Ukrainian agency, but they're just totally, rendered rather invalid now. Like, you know, like people are being forcibly conscripted against their will. People are being sent to the front line. Yes, with minimal training, a large proportion of the population are feeling it directly. Like, cemeteries have been excavated and enlarged, like the graves of like people who died in World War One and Two, like moved to accommodate this just mass kind of daily influx of bodies from the front line. If this was, you know, the US or British military that was sending just scores and scores and scores, you know, unaccountably vast numbers of people to their almost certain deaths. I think what was the life expectancy in Bakhmut at the peak of fighting, like 4 hours? This would be national scandal and grounds for a palace revolution. In Ukraine, the government has an enormous stranglehold on the flow of information. The Ukrainian citizens likely have no idea or very little idea, from at least from news reporting, on how bad things are. And of course, if you're an independent blogger or happen to have relatives in Russia, as many Ukrainians do, and you phone them, you can end up in prison for 10 years or so for challenging the government's narrative, as Gonzalo Lira allegedly is. Now facing trial and many years hard labor. Quite what's happening with him, we don't know. But yes, I mean, he is not an isolated case by any stretch of the imagination. And despite this, total blackout on the reality of the front line for most Ukrainians, if you look at polls, when Ukrainians are polled anonymously, i.e. they don't have to state who they are or any kind of identifying information, their support for a negotiated settlement or just ending this outright it kind of steadily increased. It has increased over time. People just want to get on with their lives, without the risk of their city being razed to the ground or then needing to be evacuated. Western politicians seemingly seem to slowly but surely be losing their appetite for this. And of course, this is a major distraction from any coming war with China. In January this year, there was a report from RAND which stated that, yes, this is taking up too much of our time and energy, and we need to focus on Taiwan and stoking another proxy war there. So, I mean, yes, it's obviously one wants to be optimistic and that, yes, this might be over soon. And, tens of thousands of Ukrainians will stop being killed on a regular basis for literally no reason other than a British and American desire to kill Russians. I forget the name of that official who said it was their best investment ever, like just because we get to kill Russians now. It's quite remarkable.
Yeah, I think Hillary Clinton said it was a great investment. I mean, we keep hearing that it's a great investment. Aaron David Miller, he was a peace processor who kept making sure that the Israelis could build more settlements under guise of the peace process. He was a U.S. peace processor. Now he's at the Carnegie Endowment, which is the former think tank of CIA Director William Burns. And he made some revealing comments recently. He said that the U.S. is stuck in an investment trap in Ukraine, but essentially the war is lost. And then we have this front page article from the Washington Post, which calls the counteroffensive a complete failure. It doesn't get any more clear than this, Wyatt and Alex.
Yeah, well, this is what we're seeing right now is kind of this narrative shift where they talk about this in the article about the blame game that's starting to develop between different policymakers in Washington, people in Europe. The blame game, really, they're starting at themselves, because no one has been selling this proxy war quite as hard as the mainstream media, specifically the Washington Post and the New York Times, who have been all in on this from the very beginning, who have been selling us hard this entire time on this idea that, first of all, that proxy war with Russia is desirable, and second of all, that it's somehow winnable. The fact of the matter is, you're not going to be able to win a proxy war with Russia on their periphery, halfway across the world. We could get into that, but really the counteroffensive. I mean, to me, this, all of us have been saying before the counteroffensive started, for months, since at least January, since the idea of a counteroffensive was being floated, all of us have been warning that this is not something that's going to work out for the West, let alone Ukraine, which at this point, the coverage itself is so disgusting. When you read what's in the Washington Post, what they're saying about this, you know, they describe it as, you know, you even had Mark Milley, right, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who pointed to this remark that he made a few months ago when he said, he said just a couple days ago, he said, quote, "I had said a couple months ago that this offensive was going to be long, it's going to be bloody, it's going to be slow." And that's exactly what it is, long, bloody, and slow. And it's a very difficult fight. What they don't mention is, you know, that was one remark that was couched in a whole bunch of other language talking about how it's totally worth it to continue this proxy war. But this Washington Post article makes clear, they say, quote, "While not achieving its objectives, Milley noted Kyiv's success in degrading Russian forces. The Russians are in pretty rough shape. They've suffered a huge amount of casualties. Their morale is not great." So even though this counteroffensive is an utter failure, they haven't even reached the first of three defensive lines, they're still miles away from the first line 2 months in. But it's okay because we've degraded Russia's military capabilities. This is the same thing that they've been saying this entire war, right? Since April 2022, I remember the Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, who moonlit, right, as a board member of Raytheon, in a totally unrelated development. He said, you know, 2 months after things got hot, that the goal in supporting Ukraine is to, quote, "see Russia weakened to the degree that it cannot do the kinds of things that it has done in invading Ukraine." So that's, you know, from that perspective, this is a success just from the fact that we have somehow degraded Russia's military capabilities for the time being, right? Because I suspect that at this point, it looks like when, not if, when Russia emerges much more victorious from this conflict than the Ukrainian side, I suspect that they're going to be investing very heavily in their military industrial complex and restoring it and expanding its capabilities.
At this point, their production capacity for just munitions is outpacing the U.S. I mean, the U.S. can't provide enough munitions. They're relying on what Donald Rumsfeld called New Europe, all the tools to send their entire stocks. Lithuania is sending anti-tank missiles and howitzers, which means they must not be that afraid of a Russian invasion. All that talk of Putin moving west and subsuming all the Baltic states is phony. You have this talk of a spring offensive. We're just doing an operational pause, and we're just going to chill. Everybody needs some self-care time right now. The self-care bear is coming to Kyiv, and then in spring, we're going to have attackums and F-16s, and we're going to do combined arms. NATO, you know, NATO loves all this stuff about combined arms when what they're really fighting is a good old-fashioned Soviet war with fortified cities and trenches, and the Russians are doing a better job just because they're going to their core doctrine here. They're talking about combined arms in the spring. But then you have buried in that piece that I just threw on screen a few minutes ago in the Washington Post, which is just John Hudson speaking, we've lost Clarenberg, speaking sotto voce for the National Security Council. He quotes an unnamed senior administration official saying the F-16s and ATACMs would have made no difference whatsoever. He says it clearly. So why are we going to send F-16s if the Biden administration, which has made this war one of their, I mean, this is not just a geopolitics for them. This is politics. This is domestic politics for them. If this fails, their reelection campaign is in danger. They're saying it straight up. There's no point in sending any more of these weapons. The Ukrainians are not going to hold Crimea hostage, be able to force Russia to go. So why would they send those weapons? Well, of course, the contractors and to offload all of our surplus garbage. That brings me to my next point. We saw a NATO official declare that Ukraine as a rump state could become, and this was always like the room in the rumor mill, would become part of NATO in exchange for giving Russia Lugansk, Donetsk, and Crimea. And then he had to apologize, of course, but they were floating that idea was a trial balloon. Why would Russia even have to accept that now? I mean, you had Kadyrov, the leader of Chechnya, say there's no point in us negotiating now because we're kicking so much ass on the battlefield. We can just go on an offensive on our own potentially and start taking even more territory, build the land bridge to Transnistria, go through, just rampage through Odessa. I mean, that's the position the West put itself in by first refusing to negotiate and sending Boris Johnson to Kiev in April 2022, and then rejecting negotiations after these gains that were supposedly made around Kharkiv with the Kharkiv counteroffensive. Now they're not even in a position to bring Russia to the table, and it doesn't look like they will be. So I don't know who wants to. Yeah.
I mean, that's the ultimate irony here is that these people call themselves pro-Ukrainian. They are pro-Ukrainian death. They are people who knowingly, because according to this article, that the United States, the UK ran joint war games with Ukraine well before this happened and knew this would happen.
Great point.
They knew this would happen. They all knew this would happen. We all knew this would happen. Anybody who's been paying attention to this, who understands the power dynamics at play, knew this would happen. And they said, you know what? It's worth it. It's worth it to be able to degrade Russia's military capability. It is worth it to send 50,000 Ukrainian boys to the slaughter.
Yeah, here's Aaron Mate. More proof that the U.S. sees the Ukrainians as cannon fodder. The U.S.-UK helped formulate a battle plan that, quote, anticipated Ukraine taking heavy losses, but they envisioned Kyiv accepting the casualties as the cost of piercing through Russia's main defensive line. Instead, after suffering major casualties, this is the Washington Post reporting the reality, Ukraine chose to stem the losses on the battlefield. So their vision required the Ukrainians to sacrifice.
Imagine that.
And this is a psyop against the Ukrainians. So the British and the US run the war games. Then they present it to the Ukrainians and say, look, your initial wave is going to get hit hard, but then you're going to penetrate through the minefields and you're going to come in with, you know, artillery, electronic warfare, and then you're going to have all these reinforcements that are going to gain ground. The Ukraine, and that was never going to happen. So they just tricked the Ukrainians into dying more.
They tricked the Ukrainians and they tricked all of their audiences into believing that not only was it possible, it was likely, and we should just keep sending them more weapons to make it even more likely. And the, you know, the really truly horrendous thing about this is that no one who is actually responsible for just feeding endless Ukrainian boys into this meat grinder, no one is going to be held accountable. Joe Biden and Victoria Nuland are never going to be, you know, brought up before the ICC, despite them knowing that this would happen, them knowing, first of all, pushing Ukraine into NATO for years and years and years, creating this, you know, the circumstances that made this conflict inevitable. And then once they knew it was happening, then they continue just shoveling as many, you know, it's horrific. Just shoveling as many boys into this death trap as they can get their hands on. They're literally running around Ukraine, beating kids over the head and dumping them in vans and then pushing them out on the front lines with 3 weeks of basic training. It's horrendous. It is horrifying. And I'm not somebody who takes pleasure in seeing anybody die. And you know, it's just, if you are on the side of peace, you are on the side of some negotiated settlement. Well, they destroyed that. They made that impossible. So now, from the Russian perspective, we just have to destroy this trap that they have turned our once brother nation into, because there's no alternative and there's no one who is over there to reasonable to negotiate with. Everyone's, you know, Uncle Joe's asleep at the wheel, and the neocons, you know, not that Biden is anything but that's who's running the United States foreign policy, whether it be in Ukraine or whether it be in Niger.
Yeah, I want to get to Alex.
Well, can I just add a few thoughts on this subject? I think that, like, Ukrainians have to be getting wise to all the things that we've been saying, which is that they're getting played. There was an article from War on the Rocks, which is like a think tank podcast, that said that many Ukrainian soldiers were learning to use the weapons that they were being provided with by the West by watching YouTube videos. There was that Washington Post article a couple weeks ago where it was the wife of a soldier who had lost a limb. And she said She wants the counteroffensive to be more active. We've got all these guys coming back from the front line without limbs. I want the price they paid to be reasonable. Otherwise, it's just useless what they went through. So why did the Washington Post run that quote? Like, either they're unable to find anybody in Kiev that's supporting the counteroffensive and wants to keep sending young men in, or they're trying to sow the seeds for a drawdown from this conflict. I don't know which it is, but, you know, there's plenty of people. They didn't have to run that quote. So there's an obvious reason.
So let's hear from Jake Sullivan really quickly, Human Scarecrow and National Security Council Director Jake Sullivan on the counteroffensive. This is a tweet by John Hudson, who's the author of the Washington Post article. And as I suspected, I mean, I think Jake Sullivan was kind of feeding him a lot of this for the article. But when is this guy going to be held accountable? I mean, the Ukraine counteroffensive and the proxy wars going the way of the 2016 Hillary Clinton campaign that he ran as her campaign manager. So here he is.
Yeah. Hey, Jake. The Washington Post reported overnight that the U.S. does not expect Ukraine's military to be able to reach Melitopol. Is that an accurate assessment of their counteroffensive right now?
Is that an accurate?
So I'm not going to speak to intelligence reports. I will say that over the course of the past 2 years, there have been a lot of analyses of how this war would unfold coming from a lot of quarters. And we've seen numerous changes in those analyses over time as dynamic battlefield conditions change. So what we have said from multiple podiums and multiple briefings remains the same, which is we're doing everything we can to support Ukraine in its counteroffensive. We're not going to handicap the outcome. We're not going to predict what's going to happen because this war has been inherently unpredictable. And that's all I can say today, other than I believe and have confidence in the capacity and especially the bravery of the Ukrainian fighters to continue to make progress on it.
He sounds kind of like a polished Yale version of a NAFO troll who's trying to cope with cope and seethe, you know.
I just love that he says
a NAFO troll.
Alex,
I just love that he says this war has been unpredictable when, you know, us at the Gray Zone have been right every step of the way. You know, while the NAFO, you know, Ukraine expert class of people predicted a you know, a beach party in Crimea next year, you know.
Yeah, I think wasn't like Lizzo scheduled to play there. She was going to play Stepan Bandera's flute made of the bones of ethnic Polish children. Then the sexual harassment suit blew up the whole Crimean beach
ruined
party,
it.
So. You know,
I'm not sure if you guys saw this, but Cy Hirsch put out a piece a couple days ago, kind of dissecting the failed Jeddah peace summit. You guys remember
when they
decided to have a peace summit and they only invited one side?
Yeah.
Like they're just negotiating amongst themselves. It was an utter failure, right? Nothing happened, and that's why the news immediately pretended that it had never happened. But Cy Hirsch said that he spoke to an American intelligence official who said that, quote, Jeddah was Sullivan's baby, Jake Sullivan's baby. He planned it to be Biden's equivalent of President Woodrow Wilson's Versailles, the grand alliance of the free world meeting in a victory celebration after the humiliating defeat of the hated foe to determine the shape of nations for the next generation. Fame and glory, promotion and reelection. The jewel in the crown was to be Zelensky's achievement of Putin's unconditional surrender after the lightning spring offensive. They were even planning a Nuremberg-type trial at the world court with Jake as our representative. Just one more fuck-up, but who's counting? 40 nations showed up, all but six, looking for free food after the Odessa shutdown. So you just have these scathing kind of... And it's not just Cy Hirsch, though, anymore. I forgot to put this in the document that we were collaborating on, but when we were talking about the utter chaos and disarray in the Ukrainian armed forces, how they're just going out conscripting anybody they can find, even The Guardian, which has been, again, like up there with Washington Post and New York Times as one of the premier cheerleaders of this proxy war, even they 4 days ago put out an article called Bribes and Hiding at Home, the Ukrainian men trying to avoid conscription. And they quoted a factory owner in eastern Ukraine who can't get any of his workers to show up because none of them want to get thrown into the meat grinder, right? And he said, quote, I met a guy who told me he was taken from the street. And within a week, his unit was starting to attack a village near Bakhmut. He told me, what the fuck? It is the first time I picked up a rifle. And after a week, I go to attack this village. He was shot twice, once in the arm and once in the back. And he went on to say that in Ukraine now, quote, there are two categories of people. One is already in the army and the other is too scared to go outside so as not to be conscripted. And no amount of salary will make them leave their houses. So that's the point we're reaching now, where it's just no long, it's a failed state, right? The kind of like trust that you need to have to be able to, in the rest of your, you know, community, to be able to go outside, that's not there anymore.
Yeah.
So that
quote sounds like also like NAFO, no amount of salary will convince them to leave their houses.
I mean, on a serious note as well, like this bears repeating because it feeds into so much of the work that we've been doing over the past, well, 18 months now, is the fact that, excuse me, as we mentioned, like Britain sabotaged the April 2022 peace talks, which produced apparently a signed treaty under which Russia would withdraw from Ukraine and the two breakaway republics would be given independence slash would be annexed by Russia. The idea that Ukraine will get anything like that in any peace agreement now is laughable. But so Britain's involvement in keeping this going and grinding on and getting, you know, untold numbers of Ukrainians killed on the front line. It wasn't just restricted to behind the scenes lobbying of Zelensky and telling him that, you know, we're not ready for you to stop just yet. Like, there was also a dedicated online censorship effort run by this very shadowy British government unit called the Counter Disinformation Unit. There's virtually no information on it online at all. It's been confirmed that it is staffed by intelligence and security professionals who are experts at behavior change, i.e. manipulation and psychological warfare. Now, they were, it's been admitted that they were policing narratives online around Bucha and Mariupol, particularly the ever mystifying alleged massacre of scores of civilians by Russian forces as they were leaving under the terms of the negotiated settlement that Johnson ruined. It's quite clear that London wanted to overtly and covertly ensure that no one was presented with any alternative viewpoint or indeed facts on, you know, what did or did not happen in Bucha. And yes, the purpose was to frame this narrative of genocide. And now, yeah, our dear friend Paul Mason, we know from our reporting on his leaked emails,
that Paul Mason, he British was in touch with. Yeah. Paul Mason, British journalist posing as a socialist, veteran revolutionary Trotskyist who Kit and I exposed as a security state collaborator, just so for some background for our American viewers.
Yeah, indeed. If you're lucky enough to not know who Paul Mason is, in effect, we reported on a series of leaked emails in which he was directly coordinating his attacks on anti-war, anti-imperialist leftists with a high-ranking British intelligence official known as Andy Price. Now, in the wake of Bucha, Paul Mason was in secret coordinating with academics and the counter-disinformation specialist, Amal Khan. Specifically, he was interested in attacking people who were challenging the official narrative of what happened in Bucha. Now, I mean, he was quite clearly tasked with doing that by Andy Price, this high-ranking British intelligence official. One wonders how many British journalists are in Andy Price's Rolodex and were similarly tasked with this. This was hugely significant from Britain's perspective. They wanted to frame this narrative of genocide, which the UN has investigated and found to be completely fraudulent. They wanted to keep this going, and Bucha was kind of like ground zero for this. Now, in the immediate aftermath of Bucha, Lukashenko, so make of this what you will, stated that he had evidence that British special forces were involved in the massacre. Now, none of that's ever come to light, although it might have done if Russia's request for an official UN investigation into Bucha hadn't been sabotaged by none other than Britain. So, I mean, yes, like quite whether the British involvement in shaping this narrative extended to, some kind of like false flag series of killings isn't clear, although this would be the one time that Ukraine has recaptured territory and not carried out a massacre of pro-Russian elements. Yeah, like recently we reported on leaks which showed that this British intelligence cabal who sketched the blueprints for the attacks on Kerch Bridge is in direct contact with the Odessa SBU, and the Odessa SBU expressed a keen interest in being able to spy on, monitor the private and conversations and public statements of Ukraine's quote-unquote pro-Russia contingent. Now, there have been two reports by the UN Human Rights High Commissioner, which has gotten zero media coverage whatsoever, like delving into, investigate human rights abuses in Ukraine. And the SBU is completely off the leash in terms of dragging people off the street, accusing them of being Russian collaborators on usually very flimsy grounds, brutally torturing them, threatening to kill their families, depriving them of sleep and food, and making them sign confessions, of guilt. This campaign of terror is being conducted in directly with British intelligence. They are using Anomaly 6, which again, we at the Grey Zone have exposed, this illegal spying tool, which the British government uses despite knowing it breaches a variety of national and international data protection laws and regulations. And so, of course, in that context, now that the narrative is coming unstuck and the total catastrophe of Ukraine's situation is becoming ever clearer, Britain has an even more pronounced need to suppress inconvenient facts such as their central involvement in keeping this going. Which just probably accounts for why I was stopped at Luton Airport and grilled for 5 hours under threat of arrest. They don't want this stuff emerging because, at the very least, it's very unlikely that the individuals involved will ever be held accountable. But at the very least, it makes them look terrible, absolutely terrible.
And I mean the narrative is completely falling up. It's falling apart on the counteroffensive. There is a lot to still learn about this war, and many of the propaganda set pieces like Bucha or Bucha, which you mentioned. I'm sure that I have this feeling that my analysis of the Mariupol theater explosion will prove to be fully confirmed at some point. I mean, what we have right now, the stories like from the AP that won a Pulitzer are just an absolute joke. But I mean, at this point, the majority of Americans, obviously disproportionately Republican because they're not subjected to the same legacy media propaganda as Democrats, are opposed to sending any more aid to Ukraine. So that's fallen apart. But another aspect of the NATO narrative that's fallen apart is that there are no Nazis in Ukraine, that there's no Nazi problem. That's sort of, it's important to bury that reality because liberals and the Democratic Party base, but particularly the affluent donor class, is so important to sustaining support for this war because it's Biden's war. It always has been Biden's war ever since his son got a Burisma contract. And then Biden flew into Kiev almost the same month after Mykhailo Zlochevsky, the CEO of Burisma, told Hunter Biden, "We need help from DC," almost the same month. Biden flew in, Joe Biden, and declared that Ukraine needed to clean up their courts, clean up their corruption, and dangled an IMF loan, which is wild. I mean, it says so much about what the IMF is that the vice president of the U.S. can just tell the IMF what to do. And he said, "You ain't getting your loan unless you get rid of the prosecutor, Viktor Shokin." So Biden, emerges as the kind of imperial lord of Ukraine at that point, advancing his son, his surviving son's business interests, who has a lot of experience in the gas industry, Hunter Biden. And, you know, you can draw a straight line from that to the present, how important this war is personally to Biden and the Biden administration and all the people that were in the Obama administration at the time. Victoria Nuland, Jake Sullivan was around Hillary. They were all, you know, Tony Blinken was around. They were all around each other. They were all part of this network that saw this war as a turning point in sustaining the U.S. as the global hegemon. And now it's all falling apart. But it was so important for them to bury the reality of this Nazi element in Ukraine, just because at the same time, domestically, they're pushing anti-racism, civil rights, progressivism, identity issues. So they can't be seen as supporting that. And Alex, you had a piece this week that kind of, I think, was the final nail in the coffin of there are no Nazis in Ukraine narrative. And it wasn't like you had to do some intense digging, although I think what you did was, you know, you just drove the point home by quoting from the figure who met with Zelensky. But Zelensky did this. I mean, he uploaded these images to his own Telegram account, and then he tweeted this photo out. He didn't say who it was, but it was Andrei Beletsky, founder of the Azov Battalion and the self-proclaimed white leader, the leader of white Christianity against, in his own words, the Semite-led Untermensch. He actually used the term Untermensch. That's a German word, not a Russian or Ukrainian word. That's this nice young man to the right. And you know, the Azov Battalion is rebranded into, the 3rd Regiment or something?
Well, it's a portion of the – but it was like Azov Special Forces that kind of got cut out from Azov and – formed into this new outfit. But I'm really,
this is the biggest neo-Nazi in Ukraine. Zelensky's presenting him with honors here, commending him because they put in work in Bakhmut and they're involved in the counteroffensive. And well, desperate. This is a show of desperation. So what's going on here?
Yeah, I mean, it is a show of desperation. I'm glad that you mentioned, you know, this being Biden's war. You know, Sullivan was on the phone, was referencing the Nuland phone call, the infamous one where they're planning to set up a post-coup government. But, you know, let's not forget that in Biden's announcement that he was going to run for president, he had footage of Charlottesville and really leaned heavily into, you know, what happened in Charlottesville. Now you have Zelensky meeting with the guy who founded a group called Patriot of Ukraine, which, in the words of a human rights group in Kharkov, gained notoriety for its torch-lit processions around universities that filled foreign students with terror. So, I mean, this is a guy who has made a career out of, spewing anti-Jewish vitriol. I think it's really important to note that, in Zelensky's tweet, he praised Andrei Beletsky and the 3rd Regiment for gaining 8 kilometers. So 8 kilometers is seen as this massive victory for them.
That's the metric system, folks. So if you're American, that's not a lot. That's not 8 miles.
Yeah.
It would take you about 25 or 30 minutes to run through.
Yeah. You can do it. You can do an 8K even if Oliver Anthony denounces you for eating too many fudge rounds.
But, you know, I think 11 months ago I did a story for the Gray Zone about how Zelensky had tweeted a photo of himself in some frontline town, I forget which. But in the background, his bodyguard was wearing a Nazi patch. It was inspired by, you know, the personal bodyguard unit of Adolf Hitler. And when that like caught on, when people realized that that was what that patch was and that he was sharing it, he deleted it from his Telegram, his Instagram, his Twitter, all of it. It's archived, but you know, they were trying to keep up appearances. It doesn't seem like he cares anymore. You know, it seems like he's almost signaling to the neo-Nazi forces of his country that he's their guy. Why would he do that? Well, I think that he's worried about his political future, or perhaps his future at all. on this planet, you know?
And let me just show you one thing from this video. They published 45 seconds of their meeting
with no audio.
Yeah, here's one of the guys from the 3rd Assault Regiment, which is the rebrand of the neo-Nazi Azov Battalion. He's got a U.S. flag on his hat. I mean, they've replaced their Nazi patches with U.S. flags. I mean, that's how deeply invested the U.S. is in the Azov Battalion. Why? Because why did the U.S. invest itself in the so-called Free Syrian Army and then have to... covert, you know, why? Because it was just a weapons farm for the real fighters in Nusra who actually were motivated in Syria, who were ideologically extreme and therefore motivated, and who got all the training and battlefield know-how. That's what's going on here. The Ukrainian military, you have all these conscripts who can't fight, who are lasting about 4 hours in the field, and then you have these guys who've been fighting in the Donbass since maybe early 2015, and they're getting U.S. weapons through the official Ukrainian military after being rebranded, but they're still the same old Nazis.
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to our first article that we did after the war started, you and I, Max, where we quoted Yevhen Kattas, the founder of the C-14, the 14 and C-14 referring to the 14 words, who, you know, quickly went to the front line when the war broke out. And he said, if we get killed, it's effing great because it means we died fighting a holy war. If we survive, it's going to be even effing better. That's why I don't see a downside here, only upside. You know, so it shows that's the motivation here. It is a holy war for them. And you see this in the writings of Andriy Belitsky, which I reproduced in my most recent article that, you know, he wants Ukraine to I forget the exact term that he used, but light the torch of purification in Europe and basically expel it of all migrants of color and of Roma people and Jews and anyone else that's not of pure blood.
To me, it's not that surprising. You see these guys with the American flag patches. This isn't, you know, it's kind of not really been reported on, but even a month before, you know, Russia intervenes, there was a fascinating article that came out in Yahoo News with the headline, CIA trained Ukrainian paramilitaries may take central role if Russia invades. And they talk about how the United States since 2015 had been overseeing a secret intensive training program at an undisclosed facility in the southern United States. And they had quite a few kind of interesting quotes in this, citing CIA officials. One of them said this included tactical stuff that is, quote, going to start looking pretty offensive if Russians invade Ukraine. Another one said the United States is training an insurgency, adding that the program has taught the Ukrainians how to, quote, kill Russians, how to kill Russians. So that was the courses that we've been teaching, the CIA has been teaching for the past 8 years. And so, you know, when we talk about that this is Putin's war, that this is something that, you know, that the Russians basically wanted. Well, no, we've been egging this on and encouraging this, even while publicly claiming to be promoting diplomacy. This behind the scenes has always been kind of the fundamental motivation for the U.S. activity in Ukraine. And that happened under Obama. It took place throughout Trump. And, you know, it really expanded and exploded under Biden now.
Yeah, absolutely. It has expanded and they seem to have no way out. I quoted Aaron David Miller earlier on the investment trap, but that's a negative way of framing it. I mean, you have all of these figures in the Biden administration from West exec advisors. Tony Blinken helped start it with, I think, Wendy Sherman, Victoria Nuland, Jen Psaki was even involved. And what they did was they finessed contracts for the tech industry through their contacts in the Pentagon and State Department. And the State Department often authorizes weapons transfers. So they have skin in the game. And this war has been a huge boon for the arms industry and for the contractors, the Beltway contractors, who really power the economy in D.C. through federal contracts. I mean, 60 Minutes, it's not exactly anti-war publication, reported that over 50% of the Defense Department budget, which is close to $1 trillion now, goes to the contractors. And the defense budget, thanks to the Ukraine proxy war, is at its highest point since World War II. So why would they give up this cash cow? They just need more and more Ukrainian men. And they're down to their last, they're down to the Nazis as the, you know, trained fighters. Zelensky, what comes after him? You actually have Nazi ideologues coming out and saying that they opposed him initially. You know, one of his chief opponents was Denis Prokopenko, who was the, is now the commander, the official commander of Azov forces, replacing Beletsky. I mean, there's video of him refusing to stand for Zelensky as the Ukrainian president. Now they openly say, we welcome him because he has Jewish heritage and it helps paper over our existence so we can get more weapons. So what happens after Zelensky? The post-Zelensky era is being postponed. That's why they're using martial law to delay or prevent the 2024 election in which he was going to stand for re-election. That's why you're seeing all of the opposition parties getting banned, because the crisis, the political crisis that the counteroffensive failure and just the failure of this entire proxy war would bubble to the surface. And who has the capacity to put muscle around the political forces that are propped up by the West that have failed internally inside Ukrainian society? It's the National Corps, the domestic wing of the Azov Battalion. That's who Zelensky's terrified of, right? That's who he should be actually be afraid of, because his whole thing is just, I mean, they think of him in the same way that like MAGA thinks of him. They think of him as like a comedian, celebrity, Davos homosexual, as Ted Nugent called him. They just realize he's a useful tool. But when he's no longer useful, I don't know.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I really think that's why he is extending this olive branch to Beletsky after years of feuding with him. In his first year in office, they had a public showdown where there was a news station that was hosting a TV bridge between Russian and Ukrainian civilians to like facilitate a stronger mutual understanding. Beletsky basically threatened to him. He said, "The nationalists need to talk to you. And you know, you need to have this canceled in one day's time, or we're going to have a conversation." Zelensky did come out against it, and actually the SVU opened up a criminal investigation into this news outlet, and it's actually since been shuttered for being, you know, allegedly pro-Russian as part of Zelensky's crackdown on dissenting media. And then, you know, just a few months later, in Zolo, as we reported in our original piece, I love this as background music to it, or background visual.
This is Zelensky before he was president. So this is how the, you know, if you imagine how Beletsky actually sees him. I mean,
well, what did he tell him? He told him, "We need you to be a president. We need you to not be a clown, not an artist from oligarch corporations, but a president at war." And then, so, you know, a few months later, as part of like a, you know, a peace process that Zelensky had gotten elected on because people were tired of the hostilities that by that point already in 2019, Zelensky ordered troops to leave Zolot, which was, you know, being used to fight the Donbass. And he was stood down by Azov. They'd said, "We're not leaving." And Beletsky threatened to send thousands more troops. So now, you know, they have a very public history of going at each other, and now all of a sudden they're friends. You have to imagine that the reason that they're meeting is probably because Zelensky is so afraid of him.
So yeah, that was Zelensky when he was sort of a nationally known comedian. Obviously, it was parody, but there are a lot of parodies that now are being, you know, parody eventually becomes tragedy. And that's the point that we're at now. And that also is, I mean, someone said, no wonder liberals love this guy. Yes. I mean, liberals love him because he came in as a voice of peace and is surrendered. And the only thing left is the veneer of a guy who was a draft dodger wearing a military uniform, looking like a kid dressed up as G.I. Joe for Halloween, to fight this Russian menace that the liberal member of Congress, Jamie Raskin, has portrayed as the face of global racism, homophobia, and fascism. And here you have this Jewish leader who has been embraced by the world and appears at the Oscars and every other award ceremony and is paying his countrymen through an innovative digital currency app. That's, I mean, it's a complete fantasy, and the reality on the ground is something that he covers up. So after Zelensky, I don't know how any of this can be sustained, but I think the agenda is forget about the counteroffensive, forget about spring. The West just wants to hold on to Ukraine for as long as possible as a kind of anti-Russian porcupine like Taiwan, right, to be able to get the weapons contract. And as long as they can keep Zelensky there, they'll do it. But that is what Ukraine is going to be into the future. And Russia's, I don't see them, you know, taking Kiev and bringing down the entire Ukrainian state. I don't know how they can do that militarily or politically.
And it's funny because they kind of, in the media, they treat the counteroffensive now like it's just happened June, yeah, July, like it was just this recent phenomenon. I just, looking on the Washington Post, I found an opinion column by David Ignatius, from August 31st, 2022, from a year ago. It's titled "Ukraine's Counteroffensive is More Than Just Bravado," and they are hyping up this because it kept.
It's also amputees.
It was supposed to be the spring offensive. You know, it was. They've been talking about this since a year ago. They've been hyping this up as though this is somehow going to, you know, end the war and bring Putin to his knees, and it's always been total fantasy.
Yeah.
Well, and this was supposed to weaken Russia on the, not just like in terms of its military and its economy with the sanctions, but it was supposed to weaken Russia as like a member of the so-called international community. It was supposed to isolate it politically. Meanwhile, Russia has just gained a new ally in West Africa. So, you know, it's clearly not going that way. It's only brought Russia and China closer to each other, which is what we were saying from the get-go. We said that the sanctions wouldn't work. These kinds of sanctions don't work against an economy like Russia's. I think that they can come up with pretty quickly alternatives to Airbnb and Netflix, or, you know, just pirate things. So, you know, all of the things that we've been saying from the get-go have happened. You know, today, Foreign Policy ran an op-ed: should the West keep arming Ukraine or push for peace? I mean, it's only now that they're kind of like framing it in this like black and white, you know, right, way where it's like either we keep arming them, because like, you know, for so long there was this game that they were playing where peace actually meant giving them more weapons, and now they're kind of dispelling of that notion.
And yeah, I saw Wyatt, it for the first time.
Wyatt, here's a tweet by you just to Alex's point. I mean, Russia has surpassed, I believe it's going to surpass Germany as the largest economy in Europe.
It has done.
It has done the World Bank. Russia added $600 billion of total wealth last year, according to the Swiss bank UBS. Meanwhile, the U.S. lost more wealth than any other country last year, shedding $5.9 trillion. While North America and Europe combined got $10.9 trillion poorer, So the ruble has not been reduced to rubble, as Biden promised. The Americans are getting poorer, more angry. And I'm not saying it's not clear that sanctions have not complicated the lives of ordinary Russians, but this isn't a good forecast for the economic warriors of the West. Then we have BRICS coming up, the BRICS conference, right, which we're going to provide some coverage of it. And I think this is the most pivotal BRICS meeting yet, although Putin won't be there. Foreign Minister of Russia, Sergei Lavrov, will. And what are they talking about? They're talking about at least creating an alternative financial system, not necessarily to take down the dollar, but to allow other countries that have been excluded to participate in the global economy. Ultimately, it's going to weaken and completely undermine the Western sanctions.
You've been listening to a very interesting roundtable discussion between Max Blumenthal, Kit Clarenberg, Alex Rubinstein, and Wyatt Reed on the latest developments from Ukraine. To listen to the full broadcast, go to the Gray Zone YouTube channel or visit our website, The Gray Zone, that's GRAYZone.com. You can also follow us on Telegram and Instagram. Thanks for listening. I've been the co-host and producer, Christopher Weaver.
Sometimes it's a mystery what you will hear on KPFK from hour to hour, especially during fun drives. We're trying something different this time. We want to present our regular shows with minimal disruption, giving you the content you tune in for. For this to work, we really need to hear from you. Please make your donation now at 818-985-5735 or visit kpfk.org and click donate. $25 makes you a KPFK member, but your contribution of $100, $200, $2,500 or any amount above or in between is welcomed as well. It's thanks to your help that you and other listeners are able to tune in to KPFK, where listening is always a magical adventure.
Support comes from LA Concert Group, presenting an evening of spectacular mariachi music featuring the legendary Mariachi Vargas de Tecalitlán, with opening sets by Aida Cuevas, the Queen of Mariachi,
hace mucho tiempo que yo busco,
and Lupita Infante.
Sírvanme otra para olvidarlo.
Mariachi Vargas de Tecalitlán, Labor Day weekend, Saturday, September 2nd, an evening of more than 3 hours of exciting mariachi music under the stars at the Burbank Starlight Bowl Amphitheater. For more information, visit itsmyseat.com/Vargas or kpfk.org.
KPFK's election balloting period has started, and you can vote through September 30th, 8:59 p.m. Look out for a link to your e-ballot in the form of an email from invitations@mail.electionbuddy.com with the subject line, Vote Now, Pacifica Foundation, Inc., 2023 Local Station Elections. You may also receive a text message with a link to your e-ballot. If you need to request a new ballot, file a ballot request form by visiting elections.pacifica.org. If you do not have access to the internet, please leave a voicemail on 213-635-9363. Please only file one request, as multiple requests will slow down the processing time. It's 90.7 FM KPFK.